This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.starktruthradio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Sven Kirsten. We are going to be discussing tiki culture and mid-century aesthetics. Sven, it is great talking to you.
Good to talk to you, Robert.
Sven, can you tell us about your background as a photographer as well as a cinema photographer in the film industry?
Yeah, I decided to become a cameraman when I realized my talent as a graphic artist wasn't sufficient, and I needed to go out in the world and work, with people to overcome my introvertedness. And I was, working in Germany in the late 70s as a camera assistant. And I realized that at that time there was no cable TV and stuff, and the German network was so limited that you needed to know people to get anywhere in the business. And so I decided to move to Hollywood, Hollywood or bust, sort of. And I did that and went to the American Film Institute and started working as a gaffer. I had lighting technician on music videos because it was the early 80s and it was the heyday of music videos at the time.
Were there any particular famous music videos that you worked on back in the 80s?
Yeah, I was a gaffer on Madonna's Borderline. That's when it was still unknown. I gaffed, not hundreds, but many music videos. So many music videos. A lot of them, with people that you never heard of again. But I was a gaffer on a Joan Temple video with David Bowie. You name it. I started shooting as a director of photography. My very first music video was a Tom Waits video, Blow Wind Blow. Which was, of course, I'm a total Tom Waits fan, so that was really a high point. But I also did commercial stuff, like Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire. I liked the more subversive stuff. Like I did, I shot two music videos for the Cramps, of which one of them was banned from MTV at the time because it showed Ivy's slip vibrating down her legs when she was shooting a machine gun. The song was called Bikini Girls and Machine Guns. And then when that happened, the Cram said, okay, let's make the next music video so it doesn't get on MTV at all. We did this Creature from the Black Leather Lagoon that starts off with Lux's head coming out, blood, full of blood, coming out between the green legs of Ivy, and it was, it never got played on MTV.
How did you originally get interested in tiki culture and aesthetics?
Being from Europe, maybe I had a different perspective, but when I came across the first kind of images of these mid-century middle-class Americans posing with these absurd pagan idols, I was hooked. You know, I call myself a visual junkie. I'm always looking for new, interesting visuals. It's sort of my nourishment. I understand people that decide to move from the city into the countryside, and I could never really do that because I need the steady influx of visuals. And of course, you know, now the internet, you can actually get that everywhere. That was in the late 80s. I came upon my first tiki mug. I discovered a shop called Sea and Jungle on San Fernando Road in the valley that was a supplier of tiki places. And it was like a Disneyland inside. They had rooms full of tiki decor. They even had their own blacklight room where they just had, you know, blacklight paintings and objects that would glow in blacklight. And but at the time I was going to the AFI and I was a film student and didn't have much money, so I couldn't afford to buy much. And then the third time I went back, after a couple of months of finding that place, they had closed shop and disappeared. And I always sort of credit that experience of loss as something that spurred me on to find out more and dig deeper. And I did.
So the origins of tiki aesthetics and culture, was that primarily in Southern California in the 1950s?
Yeah, if you look at my book Tiki Pop, I even go way back to the early writers like London and Stevenson that started up in Northern California. But what the beginnings of tiki culture as it is defined today, it really started in Los Angeles with the film industry and Southeast movies and music. And the set designers and craftsmen that built some of these sets, that complete South Sea Island sets on a soundstage with rear projection, seascapes in the background. And these people were then, in their free time, they were hired to build South Seas and tropical bars. And they employed some of those special effects and sort of like built these complete interior South Sea islands where Americans could enter and feel like they're in a, on a tropical island.
And the West's fascination with Polynesian culture, it goes way back to early explorers like James Cook and the artist Gauguin.
Right. You know, there was like when the first, reports from explorers like Bougainville and James Cook reached, Western Europe, they were immediately taken over by the free thinkers that were using them to criticize the ills of back then modern civilization. You know, there was already it immediately became this dream destination where you could live freely and where nature and man was in balance. And of course, that was the Western romanticized view of it, but that romanticized view persisted through the centuries and ultimately led to the Tiki Lounge.
Have you visited places such as in the South Pacific, such as French Polynesia and the statues at Easter Island?
Yeah, not Easter Island, I wish, but actually, I used to kind of in the 90s when I was, already very active in researching tiki and co-edited the Tiki News fanzine and and did slide presentations at event, tiki events and stuff, I used to say, well, you know, I've never been to Polynesia, who needs to, because it's all here, which, you know, was kind of true. But ultimately, then, in the late 90s, I started going to Hawaii because it was very cheap. You know, one of the reasons why Tiki started in Southern California and California in general was that it just, you know, it was just a hop and a skip off the coast to Hawaii, and people, once the jet travel started to happen, people could afford to go there. And so I went, and I visited pretty much every one of the Hawaiian islands, but as one of the great rewards of publishing my first book, The Book of Tiki, I got to go on this freighter cruise from Tahiti to the Marquesas Islands. And the Marquesas Islands are really sort of the birthplace of Polynesian culture and authentic tiki. And that's where Paul Gauguin moved when he moved from Tahiti. He moved to the Marquesan Islands, and that's where he died. And it's just a really great place, and it was great fun to go there on this trip and lecture during the voyages between the islands. I would hold my tiki lectures.
So you have numerous books on tiki, including The Art of Tiki, The Book of Tiki, and Tiki Pop. Can you discuss those, and which one is the most recent?
Yeah, I'm going to start at the beginning with The Book of Tiki. It still is sort of the Bible of tiki because for the first time it pulled all the various elements of American tiki culture together, and you know, not only restaurant and bar culture, but architecture and design and lifestyle and the whole mass of the aesthetic influences it had on America. And that's where I sort of put my chart together of the pre-Tiki and the Tiki era, which is something that I'm still holding on to, and which is one of the most misunderstood things that everybody nowadays is, you know, throwing anything that just has a shred of bamboo on it into the Tiki pot. But there was actually, until the 1950s, there was very little use of the Tiki icon. And to me, that's what's interesting about it, this clash of modernism and primitivism, when the Tiki appeared on the scene and became the icon of this South Seas style. And nowadays everything is, you know, being thrown together and everything is tiki, but to me, my motto is if it says tiki on it, it should have tiki in it. Anyway, that was The Book of Tiki. Then 7 years later, I got to do Tiki Modern, also with Tashin, which really concentrated on that, what I just mentioned, on the contrast of modernism and primitivism, and how those two things were basically, you know, the both sides of the coin, being on the extreme other end of the aesthetic spectrum, but coexisting together. And you know, that's still one of my favorite subject matters. Then after Tiki Modern, in 2014, I was invited to curate an exhibition at the most modern ethnographic museum in Europe, the Quai Branly in Paris. And the museum director was a fan of my other books, and he wanted the catalog to be a Tashin book. So I got together with Tashin, and we put out this so far biggest volume of all of my books, called Tiki Pop, which really is sort of the comprehensive history from the, like we mentioned before, from the first explorers of Captain Cook and Bougainville through the artists like Gauguin, then the writers like Stevenson and London, to South Seas movies, then South Seas bars, and then the Tiki period from the mid-50s to the mid-60s. And then the last one I did last year, The Art of Tiki, came out also in conjunction with an exhibition here at the La Luz de Jesus Gallery in Los Angeles. And that one, for the first time, sort of united art from the Tiki revival with the, you know, mid-century Tiki art that I have, you know, dug up. And that was fun because I really got to concentrate on the image of the Tiki. While Tiki pop is sort of like a vast overall history of Polynesian pop culture, I almost felt like I didn't spend enough material and time on the Tiki figure itself, and I was able to correct that with The Art of Tiki. And hopefully that book really, the amount of material and the quality of material in that book hopefully proves why I believe that American Tiki culture is an art form in its own right.
So with the Tiki culture, as your book Tiki Pop covers, a lot of the historic illustrations and old Hollywood films, that goes back further. But the 50s, that was really the beginning of Tiki as a form of architecture and interior design.
Yes. You can really, it's just the collection of material that I have amassed, and you compare, and it's just really evident that until the mid-50s, the pictures of tikis were sporadically used, but what was the main icon of Polynesian pop, I call it then, was pretty much the hula girl, you know, the sexy, semi-nude seductress that sort of projected a freer lifestyle. And then sort of the Tiki appeared as the yin and yang alter ego of the soft, seductive native maiden, and it made it more interesting. There's one place called the Kahlua Room in Seattle that used the logo Tiki for the first time in, I think it was late 1953 or 1954. And then around 1955, you start to see the Tiki being used more on menu covers and matchbooks, and also in the decor in these places. And that's really, the Tiki period itself was actually kind of brief, just 10 years, from I would say from 55 to 65 was the heyday. And that's by the late 50s, it really sort of exploded with Hawaii becoming a state and all this developer money flowing into the building boom here in Los Angeles and other places. And when it left the realm of restaurants and bars and was used for bowling alleys, motels, and apartment buildings, that's when, to me, Tiki became a real style, of its own. And that happened in the early 60s. And then, you know, it really sort of spectacularly fell out of favor with the big generation gap starting in the mid to late 60s, and was forgotten in the 70s and dismantled in the 80s. And I started sort of digging it up and rediscovering it as an urban archaeologist.
So I know there's a big Tiki revival right now. There's a lot of renewed interest. Was there a smaller interest in the 1980s? Because I know in LA there's this restaurant chain called Islands, which it feels very, it's definitely built in the 80s, but they're trying, it is influenced by that aesthetic.
And no, Islands is actually more 90s, or even later, I don't know. Yeah, it, you know, Islands is, I would call it more like a sort of a surf Hawaiiana chain. You know, there's a difference between Hawaiiana, which is sort of a tourist culture, which romanticizes Hawaii specifically, but does so in a sort of a, you know, very quaint, romantic way, and between Tiki, you know, Tiki to me has a certain aesthetic edge, while that I wouldn't say is subversive, but is artistically just, you know, out there. While Hawaiiana is sort of, you know, it's rattan furniture and you know, flowery Hawaiian shirts and hula girls and a lot of bamboo and all that stuff. It's more sort of quaint. And to me, Hawaiiana and tourist culture is not so special because it's like many other forms of tourist culture from other exotic places. You know, there are all kinds of places in the world get romanticized by people that bring back souvenirs and so on. So, but Tiki is its own child of imagination of the mainland America, and that's where I, you know, where the difference lies for me. And Islands is definitely not a Tiki place to me.
I know there's actually a Tiki-themed strip club in West LA near Pico and the 405, but I think they're going to tear it. It's kind of run down, and I think they're going to tear it down and put up some condos or apartments.
Yes, it wouldn't surprise me. That was one of my favorite places called Calbo's. And it's unfortunately it's not Tiki themed anymore because it's totally gutted. I was lucky to get some of the fishnet float lamps and stuff from Calbo's. I still have some Calbo's lamps in my garage. I have too many lamps at my house already. But Calbo's was a great beachcomber style restaurant that was decorated with jetsam and flotsam, you know, from all kinds of places. And, you know, it was a really classic LA place. They actually had one or two more franchises. There was one on Fairfax for a while. I think it was the original. And then they opened that on Pico. And the owners actually lived in that lighthouse apartment upstairs. You know, it has what's still standing outside is the lighthouse. But that's the only thing left, kind of Tiki or Polynesian, from that place. And it'll be sad to see that go. But it's actually, you know, it went a long time ago. I mean, was it the late 90s? I don't even remember when they closed and became a strip club called Fantasy Island. Ironically, Fantasy Island, I credit, you know, the TV series Fantasy Island as one of the contributors to the what I call the devolution of Tiki style, when people changed from the very specific Polynesian oceanic art aesthetic of Tiki lounges to a more generic tropical island look of, you know, fern bars and wicker chairs. That was sort of the period of Jimmy Buffett and Fantasy Island. So it's kind of an irony that...
So the wicker chairs, I remember my grandparents used to have a lot of those. I think those are more 70s.
Yeah, they became more popular in the 70s, but they're actually... They're a crossover from Polynesian pop to Tiki to that kind of generic fern bar look. Don the Beachcomber already used them, so they've been with Tiki for a long time. But nowadays they're more. I think they got more popular even during the late 60s and 70s during, you know, fern bar and hippie culture.
Do you have a favorite Tiki bar in L.A. or just anywhere in general?
Well, my favorite, of course, is my local hangout, the Tiki Tea, which exists since 1961, and it was founded by a Filipino bartender named Ray Buin, who learned his craft and with Donna Beachcomber, but he sort of worked at every other tiki bar in town during the 40s and 50s, even on Catalina Island at the Isthmus. And he then opened his own place here on Sunset Boulevard, and it's like 8 minutes from my house, so that's sort of my home tiki bar. But the classic ones are still closing, like, you know, Sam's Seafood / Don the Beachcomber, which really never was a Don the Beachcomber, but it was still a very authentic 1950s, 60s tiki place that recently closed. Let me think, where else, you know, there's, of course, there's, luckily there are a couple of new ones that are pretty spectacular, like Clifton's Pacific Seas. Bamboo Ben really did a great job in outfitting that. Then there is, in Glendale, there's Damon's, which used to be a steakhouse, but it's all bamboo and murals and fish tanks, and that's a cool place.
So, as far as the historic preservation issue goes, I mean, that's sort of the big historic preservation battle right now, is preserving mid-century modern. You would definitely say that a lot of them are in danger of being demolished or renovated.
Yeah, you know, a lot of them already have. I'm glad that I started documenting apartment buildings, for example, when I did in the late 90s, because a lot of those places that I photographed then, still on slide film, are gone now. It's just a sign of the times that people don't want to look dated. And what we, you know, the hipsters or whatever we are, you know, think is cool, it doesn't mean that it's commercial enough to attract renters or customers. So, you know, it's things are constantly in flux. And even if there's a revival going and it's strong and new places are opening up, old places are still closing. And there's a saying that, you know, a style or an art form is most threatened just before it gets rediscovered, which certainly is true for tiki, but so far its rediscovery hasn't helped that much. I mean, there are great exceptions. For example, I'm really proud to say that my first book, The Book of Tiki, saved the tiki look of the Tropics, now the Caliente Tropics Motel in Palm Springs, because at the time when these new owners took it over, I think it must have been around 2001 or so, Pete Maruzzi was already active in Palm Springs, and he brought the Book of Tiki to the new owners and showed them and explained to them that they had something truly unique. The name Caliente Tropics hints at what it was supposed to become. It was so supposed to become another one of those generic red tile, you know, Spanish style, but not really kind of Mediterranean places. And luckily, the owners at the inside, you know, by, you know, recognizing through my book that they actually had one of the more unique examples, really the last great tiki motel that's out there. And so they kept the style, and that's why it's still A-frame and a tiki motel today.
I recently visited the Tonga Room in San Francisco. That's at the Fairmont Hotel. That's a really magnificent place. They have a indoor lake with boats, and the lighting is really cool. That was actually a place they were going to demolish the entire Fairmont Hotel, or not demolish it, but just renovate it and destroy the Tonga Room and turn it into something bland. And I got a lot of great photos of there, which I'll later post on my blog. but that was actually a save from demolition.
Yeah, that was a great fight, and I helped Dane, you know, giving them a little bit of material to defend it, and you know, ultimately, it shows the battle of preservation never ends, because you think you saved something, and then, like, you know, all the hoopla dies down, and 5 or 6 years later, some developer shows up again and waves, you know, the big money, and you have to start all over again. The Tonga Room, yeah, luckily it was, I think it was at the peak of the development craze, and I think it's sort of the developers ran out of patience or out of money or both and gave up on it. And now it's really popular. It's one of those places that sort of flew under the radar because the drinks and the food were never that great, you know, and let's face it, that is, for the general public, that's an important factor. But now I think San Franciscans have really embraced it, and it's, the last time I was there, it was really crowded.
When I was there, it was, you could hardly move.
Yeah, and which is great, you know, it's, you can't, these places can't survive on the tiki community alone. And to see a place doing that well after all these years is really great. There's, you know, places like the Maikai in Fort Lauderdale, that's the greatest of all the tiki temples still in original condition out there. They managed to keep busy. My other favorite one is the Trader Vic's in Munich, at the Hotel Bayerischer Hof in the basement, which hasn't been touched since 1972. It was built for the Olympics in Munich. And they just, being in this sort of exclusive hotel, they always had the well-heeled clientele of the Munich upper crust as their customers. And then through the generations, their children started coming there, and now it's the children of the well-heeled, and they're keeping the place, you know, it's always full and it's always busy. And so they haven't seen the need to renovate. You know, the renovation and doing away with the original decor always happens when there's a lull and people get, you know, get scared that, you know, they're out of date, and then they, you know, mess everything up.
And another great thing about these places like the Tonga Room is they create a sense of an urban oasis.
Yeah, you know, that's the whole point of a tiki lounge, is that you walk in from the concrete jungle into a faux jungle island or tropical island, and you leave your cares and worries behind, and you're, you know, the music and the drinks help you relax, and have a little mini vacation.
You mentioned that the Trader Vic's in München. I had no idea it was an international chain, but can you go over the history of a Trader Vic's?
Trader Vic's started in Oakland, at the San Francisco Bay, and was inspired actually by Don the Beachcomber, because Victor Bergeron became Trader Vic after he had visited Don the Beachcombers in Hollywood. And Don the Beachcomber at the time in the 30s was like the happening joint where all the film stars went, and Victor Bergeron liked what he saw, and he decided to rechristen him Trader Vic and change his place that he had up in Oakland, that was called Hinky Dinks, into Trader Vic's. And he did some more research, traveled the Caribbean, and taught himself how to mix rum drinks, and in some ways even excelled, at what Don the Beachcomber had done, and franchised out to even more places. He had the backing of the Hilton chain, and that helped putting all this Teredovics in these hotels and cities all across the United States and also in Europe. And that was at a time when hotel bars were, you know, frequented and of interest to travelers, and people would just go down to Teredovics and get plastered and only have to go up to their hotel room.
And a lot of these tiki bars, they have these magnificent wood carvings. Were these expensive to build and especially requiring a skilled craftsman?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You can actually see in the history of Teredovics how he progressed from fairly naive carvings to more authentic-looking carvings, and he also progressed from having stuff imported from Tahiti, from carvers there, to using American carvers. As Don the Beachcomber and Teredovic both branched out to other American cities, other restaurateurs saw what was happening, and they said, hey, we should do that, and we want to do that. And so the demand for carvings and tikis rose to the point where local artists and artisans in California and in other places started carving tikis. And that's the point when I say it became an American pop culture and an American art form, because these mainland carvers added their own, you know, personal vision, which was sort of a mixture of cartoon style and modernism to these carvings, and that's why these carvings are so unique. You know, they're in Hawaii proper and in the islands proper, most of the carvings you saw there were more exact replicas of the actual museum tikis, because people felt the need to be more authentic and respectful of the original culture. Here on the American mainland, you know, what I've always loved about Americans as opposed to the Europeans, artists had a freer approach and they added their own touch to them, and that's how it became its own style.
And then a lot of these tiki bars also have these tiki-designed mugs, which are also wood-carved.
They're not wood-carved. The tiki mugs are ceramic, and they were actually kind of a late development. They didn't come into play until, I would say, also the early 60s. Again, Teredovics was one of the first to design these generally themed mugs. He was the first to have this skull mug and mugs with like hula girls on them. And then in the late 50s, he had a guy named Dickman Walker up in San Francisco design him a tiki bowl, sort of fashioned after authentic ritual bowls in Hawaii and the Marquesas. And that was sort of the beginning of tiki mugs, and then it's still unclear. Some people think the Islander restaurant on La Cienega in Los Angeles was the first to really put out a whole series of mugs that they, you know, served their different drinks in, and that they used as menu illustrations. And then, you know, for the urban archaeologist and for my research, the mugs were sort of the ancient pottery of tiki culture by finding them in thrift stores and seeing the names and you know, cities of the restaurants they came from on the back or underneath. It made me, you know, try to find these places, and a lot of them were gone, but they were sort of, you know, the first remains of tiki culture that people came upon in thrift stores and in yard sales.
And there's also a lot of mid-century modern furniture with a tiki theme, including tiki lamps.
Yes, you know, a lot of them, tiki lamps, for like table lamps and stuff, were made for Trader Vic's and other restaurants, you know, by suppliers like that shop, Sea and Jungle, but, you know, also mainly by Oceanic Art in Whittier, which is amazingly still around. They've started supplying and building tiki places in the late 50s, and they survived through the 80s because they you know, being in Los Angeles, they survived through doing studio rentals for productions, film productions. And then with the tiki revival happening now, they're really busy again. And they you know, what was the original question again? Sorry.
About a mid-century modern tiki furniture. Yes.
You know, mid-century modern, you know, there's that company Witco that, you know, about half of my book, Tiki Modern, deals with. They were up in north of Seattle, and they supplied sort of the rest of the United States. Down here in Southern California, we had Oceanic Arts and other companies that did sort of more an authentic job, but Witco was as inauthentic as you can be. But they really went out there by the early 70s even still. They were producing whole living room and bedroom sets with where every inch of the furniture was carved with tiki faces. When I first came upon one of their catalogs with these amazing tiki environments, you know, they had photographed these color catalogs, and you saw this tiki bar that looked like it could walk away. It was so, you know, so organically carved that, but it was all, they were all standing on shag carpet, and it looked like a set from a Cramps video. But it was actually the real stuff, and people really put that into their living and basement party rooms.
Are there any great examples of tiki-themed neon signage?
Oh, yes, many. You know, tiki really happened during the heyday of neon signs and the building as a sign, how I think Robert Venturi put it. And that's, you know, what I like about tiki. It ran parallel to space age Googie, and it had those influences. It really was modern primitivism, and so all the motels that had the tiki theme, many of them had great signage, and restaurants too.
At Disneyland, I know, I mean, the Tiki Room is really famous, but I do remember there used to be this tiki-themed restaurant, I think, was it Adventureland, which had this outdoor kind of a rainforest area, but I think that's gone now.
Yeah, it's called the Tahitian Terrace, and I think it became something like Aladdin's something. It was next to the Tiki Room, but you had to walk around it towards Adventureland to get into it, and it had this amazing tree that was all artificial, and the dancers would come out from behind the waterfall and perform in front of this tree. And yeah, it was part of that heyday of tiki and Polynesian pop being popular, and when that sort of became unpopular, of course Disneyland is always quick in modernizing and, you know, keeping up with the times. So everybody is very glad that the Tiki Room got saved and is still happening today.
This is slightly off topic, but you were telling me that you have a friend who has a book out about the history of Disneyland.
Yeah, Chris Nichols just came out from Tarshan Books, which, you know, put out three of my books, and they just do a great job, and they're amazing in terms of the quality of their visuals and the price range. It's you know, they make it very affordable. They now have this whole side business of uber expensive books for the, you know, upper 1%, where you get these collector's books for with their own stand for $1,000. But right now, you go to the Taschen website, and it's a huge book for $40, just like my Tiki Pop used to be. And I'm very glad that I hooked up with those guys, because I held back for a long time to publish my first book, because I wanted Tiki to be reintroduced into pop culture again, and I knew it had to be high quality but affordable price, and Taschen really made that possible. So I'm just putting a post together here about Chris's new book, and looking at the images, it looks fantastic. You know, I've known Chris since the early 90s, and we've gone on many Tiki expeditions together, and I'm really thrilled that he got to put out this book.
I visited Maui back around a really long time ago when I was about 13, but did Tiki aesthetics catch on in Hawaii to the same degree as California? And do you have a favorite mid-century modern resort in Hawaii?
Well, you know, like I said earlier, people felt they had to be more respectful, which I totally agree with. I'm not putting that down, but in Hawaii itself, Tiki culture and Tiki style never caught on as much as it did on the American mainland, because they were too close to the source. Being away from the source and feeling more free about, you know, doing your own thing, it's really what defines Tiki style. Hawaiian, you know, island style is not per se Tiki to me. It's what happened in America that is Tiki. So, but there are places on Maui itself, I can't think of one right now, and most of the cool places in Hawaii, like in Honolulu, are gone, like the Waikikian hotel, and it's...
Is that the one... I haven't been there, but the one that's kind of Art Deco and all pink?
No, that's the Royal Hawaiian.
Oh, right.
That's a 1930s, you know, style place, or 1920s even. I don't know when it was built, but the Waikikian was a late 50s hotel that was very influential, because it used this hyperbolic paraboloid roof line for the main building, and I think it contributed to that A-frame look becoming popular for Tiki temples on the mainland. But that's long gone. There is a cafeteria that I posted about also, that is closing the end of the month, that was built in the early 70s, and that still has a Tiki lounge, cocktail lounge. The coffee shop itself is sort of generic post-Googie. It's called the Wailana Coffee House and Cocktail Lounge. But if you go, when you enter, I think it's closing on Saturday, so if anybody hears this before Saturday, they happen to be in Waikiki, go and see the last days of the Wailana Cocktail Lounge, which is fully decked out in bamboo and has Tiki weapons and masks still on the walls. It's really one of the last places in Waikiki like that. The only other place that still survives is La Mariana's at the Yacht Harbor in Waikiki, and that is still a great Tiki bar. Ironically so, because it was put together out of the ruins of Trader Vic's and Stephen Crane's Contiki in Waikiki. When those places closed, La Mariana's obtained them and decorated their place with it, and now you can see what, you know, an authentic Tiki place looked like there, because they saved those carvings and those, you know, lamps and all that stuff.
Sven, do you have any upcoming projects that you are working on right now?
Yeah, too many. I'm branching off from tiki to other pre-tiki exotica. One of the pet projects of mine that I did a little exhibition at the Cabon Lee last year about is called Mayan Revival Style. And that was
Is this the museum in Paris?
In Paris, yeah. The Tiki Pop exhibition was so successful during the 3 months in the summer, I think they had close to 100,000 visitors. And so I got to do a smaller exhibition last year about Mayan Revival Style, which was also a specific architectural style in the 20s and 30s. Also originating in California, here in Los Angeles, there's a great example still, two great examples are actually still in Los Angeles. The Aztec Hotel, which will be the title of my book. And
Aztec Hotel.
Yeah.
So I think of the sort of Mayan and Aztec revival, I associate that more with the Art Deco era.
Yes, 20s and 30s. It was also kind of short-lived, but it was, you know, I love these fervent tangents that architects and designers go off on, and that was one of those. You know, the people that believed in that, they really believed it would have Mayan style, Mayan Aztec style would have a chance to become like the authentic American style, because, you know, architects always suffered from the fact that they were copying old world culture. You know, that's why modernism was so successful here too. But these guys really believed that, you know, to build your houses and your theaters and stuff with Mayan style was authentic, because it was basically an American, it was a South American style, but at least it was American. So they were really believing that and pushing that idea forward. And in various American cities, places like that got built, and I'm tracking them down. And, you know, I will do this book about, which I consider sort of a precursor to Tiki style, because, you know, it was another art form where pagan idolatry was used to decorate modern buildings in 20th century America. So that's one book. Then the other one is going to be a book on Trader Vic's World of Tiki, which I'm going to co-author with the granddaughter, Yves Bergeron, the granddaughter of Trader Vic's, and that's going to be a lot of fun, because there's, you know, so much great material. And so that's going to be another Tiki book. And then after that, I'm working on a book, on a visual book on the art and oddity of American secret societies and fraternal orders, which, you know, also had a lot of exotic motifs.
Oh, is that sort of like things like Bohemian Grove?
Bohemian Grove, yes, but Bohemian Grove is sort of more like a club. Like an exclusive club. I'm only touching on fraternities. There's a difference between fraternity and fraternal orders. And, you know, fraternal orders were all based on the Masons. And the Shriners are maybe the best known example of an American fraternal order that also had, you know, their iconography had a certain amount of revival, even in the Tiki community with the fezzes, which I really think it doesn't play into Tiki, but Tiki now is often used to throw in all kinds of revival styles like rockabilly and burlesque and, you know, 50s cars, which is not really Tiki style, but people, of course, the same people that enjoy Tiki enjoy all those other things, and they enjoy, you know, some of them enjoy wearing fezzes. So I'm happy that they're enjoying it, but me as a historian, I kind of, you know, have to point out sometimes that it's not really tiki because even though they coexisted at this and during the same period, they didn't have that many touching points. But yeah, no, there were some great fraternal orders and secret societies aside from the Shriners, like the Odd Fellows, and my favorite one is the Improved Order of Redmen, that were all these white guys dressed up like Indians and imitated Indian rituals and stuff. So I just love that kind of stuff.
Sven Kirsten, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Yeah, sorry for talking that much. I can talk about Tiki forever, I warned you.